It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about some developing science stories with an editor at Discover Magazine.
First, the new Wisconsin Economic Scorecard survey came out today with some surprising results. Support for toll roads in Wisconsin is increasing in middle and upper class groups. Opposition is also decreasing in lower income groups. Analysts say this could be due to people getting fed up with construction delays and road deterioration.
Joseph Serra is with us to take a look at these results and to discuss what they might mean. He's the Survey Center Director for the Center for Urban Initiatives and Research at UW-Milwaukee. Joseph, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how much support is there for introducing toll roads in Wisconsin?
Well, if you put it that way, there isn't a ton.
Okay.
If you ask about any individual fix for the projected shortfall in the state transportation fund, that's one of them. Support's pretty low across the board for any specific one. And for toll roads, about two-thirds of registered voters in the state would oppose introducing toll roads, and about a third would support it. But when you present a range of options, it is actually the most preferred single option, preferred by like about a third of state residents.
And against what other options?
Well, there are a few options. One would be a combination of tax and user fee increases. Another would be delaying major road construction projects like the Zoo Interchange in Milwaukee or expansions to I-94, or perhaps borrowing money.
And so why are toll roads becoming a more widely accepted alternative to those things?
Well, last year we asked a similar set of questions, and at that time, there was more opposition to them. But now you're seeing that dropping, and some commentators have speculated that this is because the winter was so rough, the roads are in such bad shape now. People who are from households with slightly higher incomes, a little bit more likely to travel to their jobs, and that they're experiencing the damage done to the roads by the rough winter, and that's behind the support. And I think that that's a pretty reasonable conclusion.
Mm-hmm. And your study also drew a bit of a distinction here that some people of an income of, I think, $60,000 per year or more are more favorable to toll roads than those under that line. To what do you attribute that distinction?
Well, I think it's possible that it's because that people with higher incomes they're more likely to use the roads more to get to their place of work, and people who with people from households who have a lower income, they're more likely to either not be working or to travel shorter distances to not have to spend as much time on the roads. So those people who are spending more time on the road, they've had to experience the damage to the roads that have been caused by the winter and by other delays to road projects, and that people are just kind of getting fed up with the roads being in bad condition.
And is that to say that for low-income people that they have, are they actively opposed to toll roads, or are they generally apathetic to any option because they don't travel as much?
Well, it's kind of a mix of things. It's partly because they don't travel as much, but if you look at the different income categories, there are really different answers when you say, okay, what is your most preferred option versus what is your least preferred option? So historically, people in the higher income brackets have been pretty lockstep opposed to things like tax increases, and they've been lukewarm towards toll roads, whereas people who are at the lower income to actually pay less taxes are a little bit more likely to say that they wouldn't mind to see tax increases. But the patterns are changing a little bit. Now you're seeing people in the higher income brackets being a little bit more amenable to both toll roads and tax increases to cover these problems. Now, in the lower income brackets, you're actually seeing support for tax increases to cover these problems to decrease.
Yeah, that was another surprising finding, that the support for tax increases is there as well. And did you ask how much the tax increase would be? Did you throw out some specific numbers or just a general yes or no question about it?
Well, this current wave of the survey, we merely presented a range of options, pretty general options, and just said which would you prefer and which would be your least preferred option. Now, a year ago, we asked very specific questions about a number of these options, and at that time we asked about a 5 cent per gallon increase in the gasoline tax, and that was actually one of the least preferred options out there. Only about 10% of registered voters in the state indicated that they would support a proposal like that. If you phrase a little bit more generally, support gets a little bit higher.
And did you look at all at the differences in political affiliation among the people who have filled out your survey?
Yes. So there are important differences between political groups when it comes to different options for dealing with this transportation shortfall. So Democrats are more supportive of tax increases and user fee increases, whereas Republicans are totally against that and would prefer to see delays in construction projects. Political independents kind of choose the middle road. They're the most supportive of toll roads, but they're also historically the least likely to vote.
And toll roads have been part of the conversation in the last, it's been picking up, I guess, in the last year or so. Do you think lawmakers are going to jump on this and that it might become a serious consideration among the legislature?
Well, I would say that because support for toll roads is increasing slightly among higher income folks in higher income brackets, and opposition to toll roads is decreasing among people who are in lower income brackets, it will become more of a policy option. But this is a really thorny political issue, because no single option is popular, but they're going to have to settle on a single option or a basket of options. So, I mean, any choice that policymakers make, they're likely to get attacked for politically. So it's going to be tough. It's hard to say.
What can we learn, I guess, by looking at our neighbors to the south, Illinois, that have a pretty robust toll system there? Do we see a direct correlation between the existence of tolls and the upkeep of highway maintenance?
Well, it's a fact that if toll roads were part of the mix here, that there would be more money going into the transportation fund. So I think you can say yes. And I think that Wisconsinites are very aware of Illinois' toll system. So I think that, that plays a role in people's opinions.
Yeah. So it seems that there's growing interest, though, in fixing Wisconsin's roads and decreasing the amount of inconvenience presented by our construction projects. What do you hope, if anything, lawmakers take away from the survey that you've released?
Well, I hope that people, that policymakers see that, there is at least some support for options other than just doing nothing. I mean, you can definitely see that about two-thirds of state residents prefer something other than just leaving things the way that they are. And I hope that that serves as an impetus for policymakers to act on this issue. I think it would benefit everyone in the state to see these roads fixed up.
Well, Joseph, thank you so much for being with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Joseph Serra. He's the Survey Center Director for the Center for Urban Initiatives and Research at UW-Milwaukee.
Each month we get a preview of the latest issue of Discover Magazine with Gemma Tarlak. This month she's got some news on the rise of the human species and some promising stem cell research that didn't hold up under scrutiny.
Gemma is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
We're well, glad to have you back. The number one story that you're watching right now started as just another science conference and then became an exciting reference to the Game of Thrones. tell us about it.
Oh my goodness. Well, I have to say I'm a fan of the show and of the books, but I'm too cheap to buy cable. So it was really exciting when the lead author of this new study, what we all expected on the press teleconference to be kind of a dull study about mandibles and teeth found in a Spanish cave, he opens with this elaborate Game of Thrones reference. I mean, you could almost hear the theme song playing in the background. And basically, his argument was building off the evidence they found. The paper itself was about the first time 17 skulls from a Spanish site called Cima de los Huesos, which translates as Pit of Bones. How Game of Thrones is that, right?
Yeah.
The Pit of Bones. So they analyzed these 17 skulls, and they were looking at what features they had that were primitive and which ones were more evolved. They think the skulls may be the root of the Homo Neanderthalus, or the Neanderthals as we commonly know them. But the lead researcher went off on this tangent about how these skulls show that human evolution was not kind of a nice straight line marching up to Homo sapiens, us. It was messy. It was complicated. There was intermingling and warfare and all kinds of competition with multiple Homo species from the genus Homo that were living at the same time. And he painted this ultra-violent, really crazy Game of Thrones-esque world. I think everyone listening on the teleconference kind of went, whoa.
There were no dragon bones found in the Cave of Bones yet.
Well, they haven't found them yet. You know, they found like cave bears and a couple other megafauna, but no dragons yet. Where are my dragons?
But on the serious level, this is a long-running dispute in the history of human origins. On the one hand, is this just one species across Eurasia and Africa, you know, sort of evolving along together, or is it a bunch of different, if not full-on, you know, Game of Thrones-style kingdoms, a whole bunch of different subspecies fighting, interbreeding, and all that?
Exactly. And, you know, most of us are familiar with, you know, species like the Neanderthals. Many of us have heard of Homo erectus or even Homo heidelbergensis. And a lot of times there are these species known from one or two fragments, sometimes, in some cases, many fragments. But when you actually look into the naming of early hominids, early members of the genus Homo, there are just so many. I mean, there's the Red Deer Cave people, the Denisovans, the Rhodiensis, the Adaltu. I could go on and on, but I won't. But there are just all these different fragmentary fossils, single sites, etc. And people are just really arguing with each other. The naming of early hominids is very contentious. But this guy is really advancing the theory that, hey, this is proof that we have a lot of different Homo species running around at the same time and actually meeting with each other. They're not just isolated, you know, one was developing in Africa, one was developing in China. No, they were mingling, they were fighting, they were interbreeding. So it's really fascinating. And during the press conference, he kind of dropped this bombshell that he was not willing to actually describe or to classify, I should say, the 17 skulls as, you know, early Neanderthals or proto-Neanderthals. He said he would have a paper coming out later this year that was going to kind of lay it all down. It was going to be a bombshell. And I think he's going to push for maybe even rewriting how we classify the entire genus. It's fascinating stuff and really exciting to kind of watch it in real time.
Wow. So when can we expect to see that paper due? And then what's the next thing that happens after that? In essence, rewriting the history books?
Well, it's a good question because it is extremely rare. I would say it's almost, you know, forbidden for a scientist during the teleconference for one paper to talk about another paper coming up. And again, you could kind of hear this like collective gasp in the audience, like, whoa, he's kind of jumping the gun. So, you know, research papers, it's never a sure thing when they're going to be published because they do go through review and several layers of scrutiny. So I don't know when it's coming out. He said it would be very soon, within a couple months. So hopefully we're going to see it. I really don't know what the paper's going to say, so I can't comment on what the consequences will be. But it has the potential to really make us rethink how humans evolved, how we got here as a species. And it's fascinating stuff.
Gemma, just briefly before we move on, a lot of this you've said is being based on shapes of jaws, teeth, skulls, that sort of thing. Are we starting to see any impact of trying to do DNA tests on all these remains?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, the trick is the age of the skulls that we're talking about, they're almost half a million years old. And until last year, it was unthinkable that they might be able to even extract any DNA that could be sequenced just because of the age. You know, as soon as an organism dies, bacteria infiltrates, it makes it very hard to get a good, clean DNA sample. But late last year, they started doing it. In fact, with one of those 17 skulls, one of the 17 individuals from that cave. It's a new science. They're just on the brink of being able to do it with a lot of confidence. But I wouldn't be surprised if this bombshell paper he's talking about has an element of DNA sequencing as evidence in it.
Well, another huge story you're looking at, a stem cell paper that came out earlier this year proved to be based a bit on shoddy science. Tell us a little bit about that.
Wow, this is its own Game of Thrones. This is like the stem cell Game of Thrones because this is turning into a saga with all these twists and turns. In January, Japanese researchers based at the Riken Center for Developmental Biology, it's in Kobe, Japan, they released these two papers that were huge. They were covered all over the place. Everyone got so excited. They were about reprogramming stem cells, now adult stem cells in particular. Now, we know a little bit about stem cell research in that you can take a stem cell and reprogram it to be whatever you want it to be, for it to grow into skin or brain or a liver. This is kind of the holy grail right now of research, because they want to be able to take stem cells from an adult donor and regrow them for whatever that adult donor needs. Hey, do you need a liver transplant? Let's take some stem cells from your skin, reprogram them, and we can give you a liver that you yourself grew, so you don't need the anti-rejection drugs. So you don't need to worry about, you know, how many donors are out there that are a good fit. So it's really, it's a huge deal. This paper came out, these papers came out in January, were published in Nature, which is obviously one of the huge pinnacles of peer-reviewed research, saying, hey, we reprogrammed adult stem cells using just a little acid bath, and then we spun them in a centrifuge for a while, and woohoo, we got it. We found the Holy Grail. And, of course, people went nuts. Well, almost immediately, other laboratories said, hey, guys, we can't replicate your results. What's going on? And then it started to crumble. By April, the Riken Center, which is where the authors of this study were based, the Riken Center came forward and said they were reviewing all 20,000 papers that they had ever published over the years for discrepancies. Nature and a number of other organizations came out saying that they had identified numerous errors, everything from plagiarism to misrepresenting images, duplicating images and claiming they were images of different things, mislabeling, even what they call inexplicable discrepancies. And, you know, when one of the leading science journals says, yeah, we got some inexplicable discrepancies going on here, that is a huge red flag. About 2 weeks ago, Nature actually retracted the papers, and the other investigations are still ongoing, but the fallout across the field and across, you know, peer-reviewed journals has been huge.
Yeah, how's that going to change how journals look at what they're getting, how researchers submit their results?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Science, which is sort of, I would say, the, you know, the other half of the mega peer-reviewed papers, peer-reviewed paper journals, Science has already announced that they're creating a new board. They're calling it the Statistical Board of Reviewing Editors. And the job of those individuals is going to be scrutinizing every statistic, every bit of data analysis that comes in every paper that is being considered for being published. Nature is still reviewing its own policies. It's likely there's going to be some change. And I think, you know, I don't even want to think about the folks over at the Riken Center in Japan reviewing 20,000 papers published for, you know, who knows how many years, but looking for the signs of bad science. And, you know, it's a shame on the one hand. It's a shame on so many levels. But on the other hand, wow, thankfully they caught it quickly enough that other researchers didn't try to build their research on basically what's a lie. And, you know, it was interesting, as I was reading all the various reactions, people are actually crediting social media for catching this story as early as they did, because as news of the paper came out, other researchers started saying, huh, let me try to replicate that, and wait, I can't. Can you replicate it? No, I can't replicate it. Hmm. And then this, it kind of bubbled to the surface very quickly. I mean, within months, you know, within weeks, there were serious doubts expressed about the papers, and within 4 months from the date of publishing, it was already pretty clear that they were going to be retracted, and they were in July, in a couple weeks ago.
Well, definitely something to keep an eye on. In other news, the Curiosity rover on Mars is finally scheduled to meet its mission. How has it not met its mission already? It seems like it's been there forever.
Oh, Curiosity rover. He's so cute.
Poor
he's
rover.
The little rover that could. Mm. Well, there are two reasons. Well, let's back up. The whole reason we sent Curiosity up to Mars was so that it could reach the foot of a mountain that's about two-thirds the size of Everest, called Mount Sharp. That was the whole reason we sent the little guy up there, and he was supposed to get to Mount Sharp in a year. Well, that didn't happen. And it didn't happen for two reasons. One reason is good, one reason is bad. Let's start with the good reason. Curiosity has been doing an amazing job finding all these truly, truly excellent discoveries and just really advancing science in ways they never imagined. He's taken a lot of detours to Yellowknife Bay and other sites within Gale Crater where he's roving, I should say. And, you know, he's already found there's definite presence of water long ago on Mars and how much it was flowing. He's identified what the interior of the rocks on Mars look like. You know, they're not red. It's the red planet, yeah, but that's only because of the oxide that's coating them, like a coating of rust. The actual rocks are blue-gray, just like a little planet I like to call Earth. And, you know, so he's finding all this stuff. So a lot of detours, a lot of, oh, my gosh, we got to get a picture of that. That's the good news.
Okay, and I'm sorry, Gemma, we're out of time for the bad news, but the good news is he's at Mount Sharp and ready
to finish up. He'll be there soon.
All right. Well, Gemma, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Always a pleasure.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. Based in Waukesha, she joins us each month to discuss science news. We take a look at a bird near and dear to the hearts of many Wisconsinites. For over a decade, experts have been working to reintroduce whooping cranes to Wisconsin and beyond.
But it hasn't been an easy road for the cranes, and the species is struggling with low population numbers and difficulties with cranes not being able to raise chicks to the fledgling state. And it's got experts wondering if it's time for a shift in strategy.
Joining us now to talk about the challenges to whooping crane restoration is Dr. Barry Hartup. He's Director of Veterinary Services at the International Crane Foundation and co-chair of the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership. Dr. Hartup, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, let's first get into what we're recovering from. What was the population of whooping cranes like back in the old days in the eastern United States before they disappeared?
Well, the whooping crane is a species that requires very large territories for successful breeding, and we believe it was not very numerous as a species, but we would figure that, guesstimate that there were a few thousand birds probably on the pre-settlement landscape in the 1800s.
And what happened to them?
Agricultural development, loss of habitat throughout the Great Plains and the prairie provinces of Canada. Draining of those wetlands robbed the cranes of their nesting habitat, and they got to a low of 15 or 16 birds in the early 1940s, and they've recovered from that point to about 300 today.
That's where we are now. Now, a lot of us haven't had the opportunity to see a whooping crane, maybe on a computer screen at best. Can you describe what one looks like?
Whooping cranes are about 5 feet tall. They weigh about 10 to 12 pounds. They have a long wingspan of about 6 feet and have black. They're snow white. Their plumage is snow white. They have a brilliant red cap on the top of their head, and their black, their wingtips are black in color.
And talk about what we've been trying so far to reintroduce whooping cranes to Wisconsin and the eastern United States.
Well, for many decades, the United States and Canada have been attempting to add to the whooping crane population through a number of creative means. Basically, programs that started in the 1970s and 1980s tried to supplement this population that has rebounded, this wild population and that has rebounded slowly, with different strategies, first in the Rocky Mountains, then also in Central Florida, and now here in the in Wisconsin and the eastern United States since 2001.
What's happening here in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, we have tried essentially from scratch to create a migratory population of whooping cranes that would call Wisconsin home, breed here in the south central Wisconsin in and around the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, and then migrate to the southeastern United States all the way from essentially Tennessee south to Florida.
And starting from scratch includes teaching the birds how to migrate, right? Training them on the right flight path. How has that happened?
Exactly. That was began in 2001, where these individual cranes. Now we're talking about using cranes that were bred and reared in captivity and kept from imprinting on people by their caretakers wearing costumes to make them look like a mother crane. But then also getting those birds acclimated to following an ultralight aircraft. And we found that through very just classic behavioral training techniques, we could get these cranes to follow that ultralight aircraft from point A Wisconsin, to Point B, which is a refuge named Chazawitzka National Wildlife Refuge in northwestern Florida.
And reading your annual report, I see efforts to bring them back are plugging along slowly. There are a lot of challenges, and I want to get into some of those. One of them, kind of surprised me, black flies are a problem in the effort to restore whooping cranes. Why is that?
Well, it caught a lot of us by surprise, frankly. We had done quite thorough habitat evaluations here in Wisconsin to find what we believed would be the greatest amount of habitat and very appropriate breeding habitat for whooping cranes prior to this project starting. But we don't know a lot about whooping cranes as well, and one of those issues that came to light in about 8 years ago was the fact that there are very abundant populations of two species of black fly in the Niceta region that happen to be attracted to whooping cranes. And they pester the cranes when they are incubating on their nests in spring, to the point where the cranes basically, to save themselves, need to get off the nest, and thus their incubation failures, and they don't hatch out chicks.
Wow. And then another natural hazard, I guess, or maybe not natural, I saw predators are a big part of the difficulties facing the effort to restore whooping cranes. What kind of predators are we talking about?
Well, it depends if we could be talking about somewhat larger predators, if there was a loss of an adult bird, something like a coyote, even aerial predators such as an eagle. Smaller carnivores such as mink or raccoons could take ravens even could take a small chicks because they're only a few hundred grams in the first couple of weeks of life.
And then human shootings, too. You've encountered that.
Yes, that's very unfortunate. Since 2001, we have documented nearly, I believe, about 10 instances of illegal shootings of cranes in this reintroduced population, ranging in location from the southeastern states in the Ohio River Valley and such to Indiana, as well as here in Wisconsin. We believe it's about the third leading cause of death of those cranes that we actually know how they passed away.
And I saw one person had given the excuse that he thought it was an albino sandhill crane. Why doesn't your report said basically that doesn't make sense? That's a myth. What's wrong with that?
Well, for one, we don't have a hunting season for sandhill cranes, whether they're whiter or lighter in color or darker gray here in Wisconsin. And so there is no legal hunt in this state, and this individual shouldn't have been shooting at a sandhill crane if he even knew it was a sandhill crane.
So for the for the whooping cranes themselves, it sounds like one of the biggest challenges is in the chick raising process. They get them hatched, but they don't always make it to the fledgling stage. Why not?
Well, again, from the work that led us to believe that black flies are a major impediment or have been a problem in the Niceta area, we have learned through the experimental suppression of those black fly populations that even in those years where we can where we've controlled the black flies, that our chick rearing success is not as high as we would like, and that it's very unfortunate because this all happens in such an isolated environment. It's very difficult for us to determine why that didn't happen. We believe that habitat should be adequate, that the food supply should be adequate, but we can't quite verify predation as the leading cause, but we presume that is the greatest difficulty. Our hope is that by facilitating a move of this population and now doing our releases more in the east central part of Wisconsin towards the Horicon National Wildlife Refuge area, including White River Marsh State Wildlife Area, that our released cranes will have a much better success rate at getting through incubation and avoiding black flies and hopefully avoid any post-hatching problems as well for the chicks.
We're talking with Barry Hardup. He's with the International Crane Foundation and the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership, talking about the challenges facing the restoration efforts for the bird in this half of the country, this half of the continent, I should say. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
What questions do you have about whooping crane restoration in Wisconsin and beyond? And what do you think could be done to try and help these birds in the wild? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Dr. Barry Hardup about the International Crane Foundation and Whooping Crane Eastern Partnerships efforts to restore the populations of whooping cranes, and we invite you to join the conversation as well at 800-642-1234.
Do you have a question about what it takes to get whooping cranes back into the wild and migrating successfully? Have you seen a whooping crane around the state or elsewhere for that matter? Where would you like to see efforts focus next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Ryan on the line in Mercer. Ryan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. In April of this year, I saw what I believe were whooping cranes in the area of Powell Marsh and around the Rhinelander flowage on Highway 47. I was wondering if your guest has heard any reports of cranes being in that area.
Ryan, thanks. Dr. Hardup, is that someplace one would expect to see whooping cranes?
That seems a bit far north for us, but it is certainly possible. Some of the birds that have been released in eastern Wisconsin have ventured fairly far, actually quite close to Green Bay. In their wanderings, and we do know that these birds, as youngsters, sub-adults, go on long wandering migrations. And as a matter of fact, we've had birds go as far west as Minnesota and maybe even eastern South Dakota in some instances. So it's possible, but we have not certainly had regular reports from that area.
Ryan, thanks for the call. We'll go to John in Whitewater now. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I've noticed in southern Wisconsin what seems to be a real increase in sandhill cranes over the last 10 years. And I wonder if you verify that or know something about sandhill crane populations. But the question I have about whooping cranes is what's the difference between raising young or whooping cranes that makes it more difficult, apparently, than sandhill cranes to young?
Oh, interesting. Thanks for that call, John. Good question. Dr. Hardup?
Well, these birds were raised themselves in captivity and were not raised in the wild by their own kind. There are a number of cues that we can mimic while we wear costumes and try to orient the birds and acclimate the birds into the wild environment. But we will not always be able to do that perfectly. When the birds themselves go about reproducing, even the birds here in captivity, we know that they take several tries before they seem to get it right. That seems to happen with this very long-lived species, and we would expect them to get better at it with practice.
Thanks a lot for the call. John, we've got Kathy on the line in Green Bay now. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I'm calling to ask Dr. Hardup if he would talk about some of the successes that have happened with this population that calls Wisconsin home, because my understanding is that that this experiment has so many moving parts and that in many ways it has been gratifying.
Yeah, some Kathy. Of the wins, Dr. Hardup. Thanks, Kathy.
Yes. Kathy, bless you. Yes, this is has been a very interesting project to be a part of. You realize it's almost a generational kind of activity, not something that is going to be fixed within a couple of years. The complexity in this project is immense. We're trying to restore a species to the landscape that has been absent for 125 years. We have created a number of firsts in this project. One, the birds that we have reintroduced that survived that first year after release live at the rate that the wild flock between Canada and Texas live at. They're surviving well. They're pairing with one another at a time when they should. They're breeding very early. For this long-lived species here at ICF, sometimes our birds don't breed until they're 7 years old. The ones that are out in this reintroduced population are breeding as young as 3 years of age. So there's some incredible firsts. We've had several hatchings. We had a record number of hatchings this year. We had 13 chicks hatch from 8 nests. But it's that success of getting that first generation out on the landscape that's being reared by cranes. We need them to survive, and that's where the current challenge lies.
And you mentioned one solution to the black fly problem, moving to a different part of the state to try to get away from them. What are some of the other new things, the cutting edge parts of the whooping crane restoration effort?
Well, we worked at least to get birds on the landscape with the help of an ultralight aircraft starting in 2001. Beginning in 2005, we actually took the airplane out of the equation in that instance and directly released cranes raised here at ICF into the wild at Nisida, and then now we've done that also at Horicon National Wildlife Refuge. In the last couple of years, we've been also working with colleagues from Maryland at introducing birds that have been reared by captive crane pairs, taking those young from quote-unquote mom and dad at an appropriate age at when they should be able to fly, and acclimating them briefly to a release site here in Wisconsin, and thinking that those birds might have some behavioral advantage down the road that might improve their success in the future. So these are all real novel approaches that hadn't been tried previously.
You mentioned at the outset that habitat, loss of habitat along the migration path was a big problem. Have we brought back enough of that habitat to give them a valid flight path to survive in the wild?
Well, again, what's pretty unique is, as you think about the eastern half of the United States, I mean, it's an incredibly developed landscape and very, very different than the mid to late 1800s. we knew this was going to be a challenge, but through protection, both by federal and state governments and private lands, the realization was that there was probably enough habitat to support a sustaining population here in the eastern U.S. And what really bears that out is, again, once those birds reach adulthood within a year, those birds seem to be surviving at a rate we see in the wild population in the central U.S. And so that is about as good a marker as any to say there's habitat here for these birds to survive. Now they got to start reproducing on their own. We can't just keep putting them out on the landscape forever.
What would success look like? When would you step back and say, all right, we've got a viable population out there in the wild?
Well, probably the easiest, people always are looking for numbers. We had a numeric target previously, about 125 birds or so. We've been very close to meeting that. But what really we're looking for is the fact that these birds are able to reproduce, and we're going to see several chicks fledging, flying on their own here in late fall in Wisconsin, ready to migrate with their parents, and that those birds survive to maturity. That's what success is going to look like. And essentially, we need that reproduction to offset any losses in the population in any given year. That's, to me, what sustainability would look like.
And is there a point coming up where you stop and reevaluate and say, okay, maybe this isn't moving along fast enough, our efforts aren't paying off?
Sure. We've, as a matter of fact, the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership has been through an external review process just a few years ago, looking really at critically at processes within our partnership. This is many organizations that are working to try to make this happen, not just the Crane Foundation. And we're using reviews, again, internal reviews to double-check and triple-check that we're making the best strides forward as we possibly can. But ultimately, this happens with the blessing of the International Whooping Crane Recovery Team, a group of experts from the U.S. and Canada. And they have said that they would like to conduct a review of this project in 5 years to evaluate the success that we're showing at that time. So one could say that the clock is ticking, but that it's essentially going to be a long, hard review.
We've got the state effort, a national, and as you say, an international effort. Why? Why is it so important to bring back whooping cranes to our half of the continent?
Well, this is an iconic species. It really is one right up there with the California condor, black-footed ferret, and others. It's a great example. They're a beautiful species, tall, wonderful species, a very good indicator of our landscape here in the upper Midwest, and it's a missing piece of the puzzle. And we believe that we need people who care and want to have and be able to pass down that natural heritage to future generations. And so we believe that this effort is really worth fighting for.
And when does the Wisconsin population head to the southeast?
They head to the southeast anywhere from late October into November. Most of the birds tend to be out of here by Thanksgiving or so.
All right, that'll be the next milestone to watch. Dr. Hardup, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Barry Hardup. He's the Director of Veterinary Services at the International Crane Foundation, and he's co-chair of the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership.